When the time comes and you need a weapon, look under the roots of the Minoa tree. Then, when all seems lost and your power is insufficient, go to the rock of Kuthian and speak your name to open the vault of souls.
Aragorn could not imagine what kind of weapon might be buried under the tree, nor how he would go about finding it.
"Do you see anything?" he asked Saphira.
"No, but then I doubt that Solemnbum's words will make sense until our need is clear."
Aragorn told Arya about both parts of the Weircat's council, although, as he had with Arjahad and his Lenzadi, he kept Angela's prophecy a secret because of its personal nature, and because he feared that it might lead Arya to guess his attraction to her. When he finished, Arya said,
"Weircats rarely offer help, and when they do, it is not to be ignored. So far as I know, no weapon is hidden there, not even in song or legend. As for the Rock of Kuthian, the name echoes in my head like a voice from a half-forgotten dream, familiar yet strange. I've heard it before, though I cannot recall where."
As they approached the Manoa tree, Aragorn's attention was caught by the multitude of ants crawling over the roots. Faint black smudges were all he could see of the insects, but Oromus's assignment had sensitized him to the currents of life around him, and he could feel the ants' primitive consciousness with his mind. He lowered his defences and allowed his awareness to flood outward, lightly touching Saphira and Arya, and then expanding beyond them to see what else lived in the clearing. With unexpected suddenness, he encountered an immense entity, a sentient being of such a colossal nature he could not grasp the limits of its psyche. Even Oromus's vast intellect, which Aragorn had been in contact with in Farthendur, was dwarfed in comparison to this presence. The very air seemed to thrum with the energy and strength that emanated from the tree? The source was unmistakable. Deliberate and inexorable, the tree's thoughts moved at a measured pace, as slow as the creep of ice over granite. It took no notice of Aragorn, nor, he was sure, of any single individual. It was entirely concerned with the affairs of things that grow and flourish in the bright sunlight, with the dogbane and the lily, the evening primrose and the silky foxglove, and the yellow mustard tall beside the crabapple with its purple blossoms.
"It's awake!" exclaimed Aragorn, shocked into speaking. "I mean, it's intelligent!"
He knew that Saphira felt it too. She cocked her head toward the Manoa tree as if listening, then flew to one of its branches, which were as thick as the road from Carverhall to Therensford. There she perched with her tail hanging free, waving the tip of it back and forth ever so gracefully. It was such an odd sight, a dragon in a tree, that Aragorn almost laughed.
"Of course she's awake," said Arya.
Her voice was low and mellow in the night air.
"Shall I tell you the story of the Manoa tree?"
"I'd like that."
A flash of white streaked across the sky like a banished spectre, and resolved itself beside Saphira in the form of Blagden. The raven's narrow shoulders and crooked neck gave him the appearance of a miser basking in the radiance of a pile of gold. The raven lifted his pallid head and uttered his ominous cry,
"Werda!"
"This is what happened. Once there lived a woman, Linnea, in the years of spice and wine, before our war with the dragons, and before we became as immortal as any being still composed of vulnerable flesh can be. Linnea had grown old, without the comfort of a mate or children, nor did she feel the need to seek them out, preferring to occupy herself with the art of singing to plants, of which she was a master. That is, she did, until a young man came to her door and beguiled her with words of love. His affections woke a part of Linnea that she had never suspected existed, a craving to experience the things that she had unknowingly sacrificed. The offer of a second chance was too great an opportunity for her to ignore. She deserted her work and devoted herself to the young man, and for a time they were happy. But the young man was young, and he began to long for a mate closer to his own age. His eye fell upon a young woman, and he wooed and won her. And for a time, they too were happy.
When Linnea discovered that she had been spurned, scorned, and abandoned, she went mad with grief. The young man had done the worst possible thing. He had given her a taste of the fullness of life, then torn it away with no more thought than a rooster flitting from one hen to the next. She found him with the woman, and in her fury she stabbed him to death. Linnea knew that what she had done was evil. She also knew that even if she was exonerated of the murder, she could not return to her previous existence. Life had lost all joy for her. So she went to the oldest tree in Duweldenwaden, pressed herself against it, and sang herself into the tree, abandoning all allegiance to her own race. For 3 days and 3 nights she sang, and when she finished, she had become one with her beloved plants, and through all the millennia since she has kept watch over the forest. Thus was the Manoa tree created. At the conclusion of her tale, Arya and Aragorn sat side by side on the crest of a huge root, 12 feet off the ground. Aragorn bounced his heels against the tree, and wondered if Arya had intended the story as a warning to him, or if it was merely an innocent piece of history. His doubt hardened into certainty when she asked, "Do you think that the young man was to blame for the tragedy?" "I think," he said, knowing that a clumsy reply could turn her against him, "that what he did was cruel, and that Linnea overreacted. They were both at fault." Arya stared at him until he was forced to avert his gaze. "They weren't suited for each other." Aragorn began to deny it, but then stopped himself. She was right, and she had manoeuvred him so that he had to say it out loud, so that he had to say it to her. "Perhaps," he admitted. Silence accumulated between them like sand piling into a wall that neither of them was willing to breach. The high-pitched hum of cicadas echoed from the edge of the clearing. At last he said, "Being home seems to agree with you."
"It does."
With unconscious ease, she leaned over and picked up a thin branch that had fallen from the manoa tree and began to weave the clumps of needles into a small basket. Hot blood rushed to Aragorn's face as he watched her. He hoped that the moon was not bright enough to reveal that his cheeks had turned mottled red.
Where do you live? Do you and Islanzadi have a palace or castle?" "We live in Tildari Hall, our family's ancestral buildings in the western part of Ellesmere. I would enjoy showing our home to you."
"Ah." The practical question suddenly intruded in Aragorn's muddled thoughts, driving away his embarrassment.
"Arya, do you have any siblings?"
She shook her head.
"Then you are the sole heir to the Elven throne." "Of course. Why do you ask?"
She sounded bemused by his curiosity.
"I don't understand why you were allowed to become an ambassador to the Varden and dwarves, as well as ferry Saphira's egg from here to Trondheim. It's too dangerous an errand for a princess, much less the queen-in-waiting." "You mean it's too dangerous for a human woman. I told you before that I am not one of your helpless females. What you fail to realize is that we view our monarchs differently than you or the dwarves. To us, a king or queen's highest responsibility is to serve their people, however and wherever possible. If that means forfeiting our lives in the process, we welcome the opportunity to prove our devotion to, as the dwarves say, hearth, hall, and honour. If I had died in the course of my duty, then a replacement successor would have been chosen from among our various houses. Even now I would not be required to become queen if I found the prospect distasteful. We do not choose leaders who are unwilling to devote themselves wholeheartedly to their obligation." She hesitated, then hugged her knees against her chest and propped her chin on them. "I had many years to perfect those arguments with my mother." For a minute, the wheat of the cicadas went undisturbed in the clearing. Then she asked, "How go your studies with Oromis?" Aragorn grunted as his foul temper returned on a wave of unpleasant memories, souring his pleasure at being with Arya. All he wanted to do was crawl into bed, go to sleep, and forget the day. "Oromis Elder,"
he said, working each word around his mouth before letting it escape, "is quite thorough." He winced as she gripped his upper arm with bruising strength. "What has gone amiss?" He tried to shrug her hand off. "Nothing. I've travelled with you long enough to know when you're happy, angry, or in pain. Did something happen between you and Oremus? If so, you have to tell me, so that it can be rectified as soon as possible. Or was it your back? We could—" "It's not my training." Despite his pique, Aragorn noticed that she seemed genuinely concerned, which pleased him. "Ask Saphira, she can tell you." "I want to hear it from you," she said quietly. The muscles in Aragorn's jaw spasmed as he clenched his teeth. In a low voice, no more than a whisper, he first described how he had failed at his meditation in the glade, then the incident that poisoned his heart like a viper coiled in his chest. His blessing. Arya released his arm and clutched at the root of the Manoa tree as if to steady herself.
"Barzul!"
The dwarf curse alarmed him. He had never heard her use profanity before, and this one was particularly apt, for it meant ill fate.
"I knew of your act in Farthendur for sure, but I never thought, I never suspected that such a thing could occur. I cry your pardon, Aragorn, for forcing you to leave your rooms tonight. I did not comprehend your discomfort. You must want to be alone."
"No," he said, "no, I appreciate the company and the things you've shown me." He smiled at her, and after a moment she smiled back. Together they sat, small and still, at the base of the ancient tree, and watched the moon arch high over the peaceful forest before it hid behind the gathering clouds. "I only wonder what will become of the child." High above their heads, Blugden ruffled his bone-white feathers and shrieked, "Weirda!" A maze of opposition. Nasuada crossed her arms without bothering to conceal her impatience as she examined the two men before her. The one on the right had a neck so thick it forced his head to jut forward at nearly right angles to his shoulders, giving him a stubborn, dim-witted appearance. This was intensified by his heavy brow, with its two cliffs of matted hair almost long enough to pull over his eyes, and bulbous lips that remained puckered into a pink mushroom even when he spoke. She knew better than to put stock in his repulsive looks, though. No matter its rough housing, his tongue was as clever as a jester's. The only identifying feature of the second man was his pale skin, which refused to darken under Surda's relentless sun, even though the Varden had been in Aberon, the capital, for some weeks now. From his colouring, Nasuada guessed he had been born in the northern reaches of the Empire. He held a knit wooled cap that he wrung into a hard rope between his hands.
"You," she said, pointing at him. "How many of your chickens did he kill again?"
13, ma'am."
Nasuada returned her attention to the ugly man.
"An unlucky number, by all accounts, Master Gamble. And so it has proved for you. You are guilty of both theft and destroying someone else's property without offering proper recompense."
"I never denied it."
"I only wonder how you ate 13 chickens in 4 days. Are you ever full, Master Gamble?"
He gave her a jocular grin and scratched the side of his face. The rasp of his untrimmed fingernails over his stubble annoyed her, and it was only with an effort of will that she kept from asking him to stop.
"Well, not to be disrespectful, ma'am, but filling my stomach wouldn't be a problem if you fed us properly. What with all the work we do? I'm a large man, and I need a bit of meat in my belly after half a day breaking rocks with a mattock. I did my best to resist temptation, I did. But 3 weeks of short rations and watching those farmers drive around fat livestock they wouldn't share even if a body was starving, well, I admit it broke me. I'm not a strong man when it comes to food. I like it hot and I like plenty of it, and I don't fancy I'm the only one willing to help himself."
"And that's the heart of the problem," reflected Nasuada.
The Varden could not afford to feed its members, not even with Surda's king Orin helping. Orin had opened his treasury to them, but he had refused to behave as Galbatorix was wont to do when moving his army across the Empire, which was to appropriate supplies from his countrymen without paying for them.
"A noble sentiment, but one that only makes my task harder.
Still, she knew that acts like those were what separated her, Orin, Hrothgar and Islandzadi from Galbatorix's despotism. It would be so easy to cross that divide without noticing it. I understand your reasons, Master Gamble. However, although the Varden aren't a country and we answer to no one's authority but our own, that does not give you or anyone else leave to ignore the rule of law as laid down by my predecessors, or as it's observed here in Surda. Therefore I order you to pay a copper for each chicken you stole. Gamble surprised her by acceding without protest.
As you wish, ma'am, he said.
That's it, exclaimed the pale man.
He wrung his cap even tighter.
That's no fair price. If I sold them in any market, they'd...
She could not contain herself any longer.
Yes, you'd get more. But I happen to know that Master Gamble cannot afford to give you the chickens full price, as I am the one who provides his salary, as I do yours. You forget that if I decided to acquire your poultry for the good of the Varden, you'd get no more than a copper a chicken, and be lucky at that. Am I understood?
He can't...
Am I understood?
After a moment, the pale man subsided and muttered,
Yes, ma'am.
Very well, you are both dismissed. With an expression of sardonic admiration, Gamble touched his brow and bowed to Nasawada, before backing out of the stone door with his sullen opponent. You too, she said to the guards on either side of the door. As soon as they were gone, she slumped in her chair with an exhausted sigh and reached for her fan, batting it over her face in a futile attempt to dissipate the pinpricks of sweat that accumulated on her forehead. The constant heat drained her strength and made even the smallest task arduous. She suspected she would feel tired even if it were winter. Familiar as she was with the innermost secrets of the Varden, it still had taken more work than she expected to transport the entire organization from Farthendur through the Beor Mountains and deliver them to Surda and Avaron. She shuddered, remembering long, uncomfortable days spent in the saddle. Planning and executing their departure had been exceedingly difficult, as was integrating the Varden into their new surroundings while simultaneously preparing for an attack on the Empire.
I don't have enough time each day to solve all these problems, she lamented.
Finally, she dropped the fan and rang the bell pull, summoning her handmaid, Farika. The banner hanging to the right of the cherrywood desk rippled as the door behind it opened. Farika slipped out to stand with downcast eyes by Nasawada's elbow.
Are there any more? Asked Nasawada. No, ma'am.
She tried not to let her relief show. Once a week she held an open court to resolve the Varden's various disputes. Anyone who felt that they had been wronged could seek an audience with her and ask for her judgment. She could not imagine a more difficult and thankless chore. As her father had often said after negotiating with Hrothgar, a good compromise leaves everyone angry. And so it seemed. Returning her attention to the matter at hand, she told Farika, I want that Gamble reassigned. Give him a job where his talent with words will be of some use. Quartermaster, perhaps. Just so long as it's a job where he'll get full rations. I don't want to see him before me for stealing again. Farika nodded and went to the desk, where she recorded Nasawada's instructions on a parchment scroll. That skill alone made her invaluable. Farika asked,
Where can I find him?
One of the work gangs in the quarry.
Yes, ma'am. Oh, while you were occupied, King Orin asked that you join him in his laboratory. What has he done in there now? Blind himself?
Nasawada washed her wrists and neck with lavender water, then checked her hair in the mirror of polished silver that Orin had given her, and tugged on her overgown until the sleeves were straight. Satisfied with her appearance, she swept out of her chambers, with Farika in tow. The sun was so bright today that no torches were needed to illuminate the inside of Borromeo Castle, nor could their added warmth have been tolerated. Shafts of light fell through the cross-letted arrow slits and glowed upon the inner wall of the corridor, striping the air with bars of golden dust at regular intervals. Nasawada looked out one embrasure toward the barbican, where 30 or so of Orin's orange-clad cavalry soldiers were setting forth on another of their ceaseless rounds of patrols in the countryside surrounding Avaron. Not that they could do much good if Galbatorix decided to attack us himself, she thought bitterly. Their only protection against that was Galbatorix's pride, and, she hoped, his fear of Aragon. All leaders were aware of the risk of usurpation, but usurpers themselves were doubly afraid of the threat that a single determined individual could pose. Nasuada knew that she was playing an exceedingly dangerous game with the most powerful madman in Alagasia. If she misjudged how far she could push him, she and the rest of the Varden would be destroyed, along with any hope of ending Galbatorix's reign. The clean smell of the castle reminded her of the time she had stayed there as a child, back when Orin's father, King Larkin, still ruled. She never saw much of Orin then. He was 5 years older than her, and already occupied with his duties as a prince. Nowadays, though, she often felt as if she were the elder one. At the door to Orin's laboratory, she had to stop and wait for his bodyguards, who were always posted outside, to announce her presence to the king. Soon, Orin's voice boomed out into the stairwell.
"Lady Nasuada, I'm so glad you came. I have something to show you."
Mentally bracing herself, she entered the laboratory with Farrica. A maze of tables laden with a fantastic array of alembics, beakers and retorts confronted them, like a glass thicket waiting to snag their dresses on any one of its myriad fragile branches. The heavy odour of metallic vapours made Nasuada's eyes water. Lifting their hems off the floor, she and Farrica wended their way in single file toward the back of the room, past hourglasses and scales, arcane tomes bound with black iron, dwarven astrolabes, and piles of phosphorescent crystal prisms that produced fitful blue flashes. They met Orin by a marble-topped bench, where he stirred a crucible of quicksilver with a glass tube that was closed at one end, open at the other, and must have measured at least 3 feet in length, although it was only a quarter of an inch thick. "Sire," said Nasuada. As befitted one of equal rank to the king, she remained upright while Farrica curtsied. "You seem to have recovered from the explosion last week." Orin grimaced good-naturedly.
"I learned that it's not wise to combine phosphorus and water in an enclosed space. The result can be quite violent."
"Has all of your hearing returned?"
"Not entirely, but..."
Grinning like a boy with his first dagger, he lit a taper with the coals from a brazier, which she could not fathom how he endured in the stifling weather, carried the flaming brand back to the bench, and used it to start a pipe packed with cardus weed. "I didn't know that you smoked."
"I don't, really," he confessed, "except that I found that since my eardrum hasn't completely sealed up yet, I can do this."
Drawing on the pipe, he puffed out his cheeks until a tendril of smoke issued from his left ear, like a snake leaving its den, and coiled up the side of his head. It was so unexpected, Nasuada burst out laughing, and after a moment Orin joined her, releasing a plume of smoke from his mouth.
"It's the most peculiar sensation," he confided. "Tickles like crazy on the way out."
Growing serious again, Nasuada asked, "Was there something else that you wished to discuss with me, sire?" He snapped his fingers.
"Of course!"
Dipping his long glass tube in the crucible, he filled it with quicksilver, then capped the open end with one finger and showed the whole thing to her.
"Would you agree that the only thing in this tube is quicksilver?"
"I would."
"Is this why he wanted to see me?
And what about now?"
With a quick movement, he inverted the tube and planted the open end inside the crucible, removing his finger. Instead of all pouring out, as Nasuada expected, the quicksilver in the tube dropped about halfway, then stopped and held its position. Orin pointed to the empty section above the suspended metal. He asked,
"What occupies that space?"
"It must be air," asserted Nasuada. Orin grinned and shook his head.
"If that were true, how would the air bypass the quicksilver or diffuse through the glass? No routes are available by which the atmosphere can gain admission."
He gestured at Farrica.
"What's your opinion, maid?"
Farrica stared at the tube, then shrugged and said,
"It can't be nothing, sire."
"Ah, but that's exactly what I think it is. Nothing. I believe that I've solved one of the oldest conundrums of natural philosophy by creating and proving the existence of a vacuum." It completely invalidates Vatcher's theories and means that Ladin was actually a genius. Blasted elves always seem to be right.
Nasuada struggled to remain cordial as she asked, "What purpose does it serve, though?"
"Purpose?" Orin looked at her with genuine astonishment. "None, of course. At least not that I can think of. However, this will help us to understand the mechanics of our world, how and why things happen. It's a wondrous discovery. Who knows what else it might lead to?"
While he spoke, he emptied the tube and carefully placed it in a velvet-padded box that held similar delicate instruments.
"The prospect that truly excites me, though, is of using magic to ferret out nature's secrets. Why, just yesterday, with a single spell, Triana helped me to discover two entirely new gases. Imagine what could be learned if magic was systematically applied to the disciplines of natural philosophy. I'm considering learning magic myself, if I have a talent for it, and if I can convince some magic users to divulge their knowledge."
"It's a pity that your dragon rider Aragorn didn't accompany you here. I'm sure that he could help me."
Looking at Farrakhan, Nasuada said, "Wait for me outside." The woman curtsied and then departed. Once Nasuada heard the door to the laboratory close, she said,
"Orin, have you taken leave of your senses?"
"Whatever do you mean?"
"While you spend your time locked in here conducting experiments that no one understands, endangering your well-being in the process, your country totters on the brink of war. A myriad issues await your decision, and you stand here blowing smoke and playing with quicksilver."
His face hardened.
"I am quite aware of my duties, Nasuada. You may lead the Varden, but I'm still King of Cirda, and you would do well to recall that before you speak so disrespectfully. Need I remind you that your sanctuary here depends on my continued goodwill?"
She knew it was an idle threat. Many of the Cirdan people had relatives in the Varden, and vice versa. They were too closely linked for either of them to abandon the other. No, the real reason that Orin had taken offence was the question of authority. Since it was nigh impossible to keep large groups of armed warriors at the ready over extended periods of time, as Nasuada had learned, feeding that many inactive people was a logistical nightmare, the Varden had begun taking jobs, starting farms, and otherwise assimilating into their host country.
"Where will that leave me eventually? As the leader of a non-existent army? A general or counsellor under Orin?"
Her position was precarious. If she moved too quickly or with too much initiative, Orin would perceive it as a threat and turn against her, especially now that she was cloaked in the glamour of the Varden's victory in Farthendur. But if she waited too long, they would lose their chance to exploit Galbatorix's momentary weakness. Her only advantage over the maze of opposition was her command of the one element that had instigated this act of the play. Aragorn and Saphira. She said,
"I don't seek to undermine your command, Orin. That was never my intention, and I apologize if it appeared that way."
He bowed his neck with a stiff bob. Unsure of how to continue, she leaned on her fingertips against the lip of the bench.
"It's only so many things must be done. I work night and day. I keep a tablet beside my bed for notes, and yet I never catch up. I feel as if we are always balanced on the brink of disaster."
Orin picked up a pestle stained black from use and rolled it between his palms with a steady, hypnotic rhythm.
"Before you came here... No, that's not right. Before your rider materialized fully from the ethers like Moratensis from his fountain, I expected to live my life as my father and grandfather before me. That is, opposing Galbatorix in secret. You must excuse me if it takes a while to accustom myself to this new reality."
It was as much contrition as she could expect in return.
"I understand."
He stopped the pestle in its path for a brief moment.
"You are newly come to your power, whereas I have held mine for a number of years. If I may be arrogant enough to offer advice,
I've found that it's essential for my sanity to allocate a certain portion of the day for my own interests. I couldn't do that, objected Nasuada. Every moment I waste might be the moment of effort that's needed to defeat Galbatorix. The pestle paused again. You do the Varden a disservice if you insist on overworking yourself. No one can function properly without occasional peace and quiet. They don't have to be long breaks, just 5 or 10 minutes. You could even practice your archery, and then you would still serve your goals, albeit in a different manner. That's why I had this laboratory constructed in the first place. That's why I blow smoke and play with quicksilver, as you put it, so that I don't scream with frustration throughout the rest of the day. Despite her reluctance to surrender her view of Orin as a feckless layabout, Nasuada could not help but acknowledge the validity of his argument. I will keep your recommendation in mind. Some of his former levity returned as he smiled. That's all I ask. Walking to the window, she pushed the shutters farther open and gazed down upon Aberon, with its cries of quick-fingered merchants hawking their wares to unsuspecting customers, the clotted yellow dust blowing from the western road as a caravan approached the city gates, the air that shimmered over clay-tile roofs and carried the scent of cardasweed and incense from the marble temples and the fields that surrounded Aberon, like the outstretched petals of a flower. Without turning around, she asked, "Have you received copies of our latest reports from the Empire?" "I have." He joined her at the window. "What's your opinion of them?" "That they're too meagre and incomplete to extract any meaningful conclusions." "They're the best we have, though. Give me your suspicions and your hunches. Extrapolate from the known facts, like you would if this was one of your experiments." She smiled to herself. "I promise that I won't attach meaning to what you say." She had to wait for his reply, and when it came, it was with the dolorous weight of a doomsday prophecy. "Increased taxes, empty garrisons, horses and oxen confiscated throughout the Empire. It seems that Galbatorix gathers his forces in preparation to confront us, though I cannot tell whether he means to do it in offence or defence." Revolving shadows cooled their faces as a cloud of starlings whirled across the sun. "The question that weighs upon my mind now is how long will it take him to mobilize, for that will determine the course of our strategies." "Weeks, months, years. I cannot predict his actions." He nodded. "Have your agents continued to spread tidings of Aragon?" "It has become increasingly dangerous, but yes. My hope is that if we inundate cities like Dras Leona with rumours of Aragon's prowess, when we actually reach the city and they see him, they will join us of their own accord and we can avoid a siege." "War is rarely so easy." She let the comment pass uncontested. "And how fares the mobilization of your own army? The Varden, as always, are ready to fight." Orin spread his hands in a placating gesture. "It's difficult to rouse a nation, Nasuada. There are nobles who I must convince to back me, armour and weapons to be constructed, supplies to be gathered. And in the meantime, how do I feed my people? We need more land than you allotted us." "Well, I know it," he said, "and we'll only get it by invading the Empire, unless you fancy making the Varden a permanent addition to Surda. If so, you'll have to find homes for the thousands of people I brought from Farthan Dûr, which won't please your existing citizens. Whatever your choice, choose quickly, because I fear that if you continue to procrastinate, the Varden will disintegrate into an uncontrollable horde." She tried not to make it sound like a threat. Nevertheless, Orin obviously did not appreciate the insinuation. His upper lip curled, and he said, "Your father never let his men get out of hand. I trust you won't either, if you expect to remain leader of the Varden. As for our preparations, there's a limit to what we can do in so short a time. You'll just have to wait until we are ready." She gripped the windowsill until veins stood out on her wrists and her fingernails sank into the crevices between the stones, yet she allowed none of her anger to colour her voice. "In that case, will you lend the Varden more gold for food?"
No, I've given you all the money I can spare.
How will we eat, then?
I would suggest that you raise the funds yourself.
Furious, she gave him her widest, brightest smile, holding it long enough to make him shift with unease, and then curtsied as deeply as a servant, never letting her demented grimace waver. Farewell, then, sire. I hope that the rest of your day is as enjoyable as our conversation was. Orin muttered an unintelligible response as she swept back to the laboratory's entrance. In her anger, Nasuada caught her right sleeve on a jade bottle and knocked it over, cracking the stone and releasing a flood of yellow liquid that splattered her sleeve and soaked her skirt. She flicked her wrist in annoyance without stopping.
Farika rejoined her in the stairwell, and together they traversed the warren of passageways to Nasuada's chambers.
Hanging by a thread. Throwing open the doors to her rooms, Nasuada strode to her desk, then dropped into a chair, blind to her surroundings. Her spine was so rigid that her shoulders did not touch the back. She felt frozen by the insoluble quandary the Varden faced. The rise and fall of her chest slowed until it was imperceptible.
"I have failed," was all she could think.
"Mom, your sleeve!"
Jolted from her reverie, Nasuada looked down to find Farika beating at her right arm with a cleaning rag. A wisp of smoke rose from the embroidered sleeve. Alarmed, Nasuada pushed herself out of the chair and twisted her arm, trying to find the cause of the smoke. Her sleeve and skirt were disintegrating into chalky cobwebs that emitted acrid fumes.
"Get me out of this," she said.
She held her contaminated arm away from her body and forced herself to remain still as Farika unlaced her overgown. The handmaid's fingers scrabbled against Nasuada's back with frantic haste, fumbling with the knots, and then finally loosening the wool shell that encased Nasuada's torso. As soon as the overgown sagged, Nasuada yanked her arms out of the sleeves and clawed her way free of the robe. Panting, she stood by the desk, clad only in her slippers and linen chemise. To her relief, the expensive chainsail had escaped harm, although it had acquired a foul reek.
"Did it burn you?" asked Farika.
Nasuada shook her head, not trusting her tongue to respond. Farika nudged the overgown with the tip of her shoe.
"What evil is this?"
"One of Orin's foul concoctions," croaked Nasuada. "I spilled it in his laboratory."
Calming herself with long breaths, she examined the ruined gown with dismay. It had been woven by the dwarf women of Durgrindstingetum as a gift for her last birthday, and was one of the finest pieces in her wardrobe. She had nothing to replace it, nor could she justify commissioning a new dress, considering the Varden's financial difficulties. "Somehow I will have to make do without." Farika shook her head.
"It's a shame to lose such a pretty dress."
She went round the desk to a sewing basket and returned with a pair of etched scissors.
"We might as well save as much of the cloth as we can. I'll cut off the ruined parts and have them burned."
Nasuada scowled and paced the length of the room, seething with anger at her own clumsiness and at having another problem added to her already overwhelming list of worries.
"What am I going to wear to court now?" she demanded.
The scissors bit into the soft wool with brisk authority.
"Mayhap your linen dress. It's too casual to appear in before Orin and his nobles." "Give me a chance with it, ma'am. I'm sure that I can alter it so it's serviceable. By the time I'm done, it'll look twice as grand as this one ever did." "No, no, it won't work. They'll just laugh at me. It's hard enough to command their respect when I'm dressed properly, much less if I'm wearing patched gowns that advertise our poverty."
The older woman fixed Nasuada with a stern gaze.
"It will work, so long as you don't apologize for your appearance. Not only that, I guarantee that the other ladies will be so taken with your new fashion that they'll imitate you. Just you wait and see."
Going to the door, she cracked it open and handed the damaged fabric to one of the guards outside.
"Your mistress wants this burned. Do it in secret and breathe not a word of this to another soul, or you'll have me to answer to."
The guard saluted. Nasuada could not help smiling.
"How would I function without you, Farika?" "Quite well, I should think."
After donning her green hunting frock, which with its light skirt provided some respite from the day's heat, Nasuada decided that even though she was ill-disposed toward Orin, she would take his advice and break with her regular schedule to do nothing more important than help Faraka rip out stitches from the overgown. She found the repetitive task an excellent way to focus her thoughts. While she pulled on the threads, she discussed the Varden's predicament with Faraka, in the hope that she might perceive a solution that had escaped Nasuada. In the end, Faraka's only assistance was to observe,
"Seems most matters in this world have their root in gold. If we had enough of it, we could buy Galbatorix right off his black throne. Might not even have to fight his men. Did I really expect that someone else would do my job for me?" Nasuada asked herself. "I led us into this blind, and I have to lead us out."
Intending to cut open a seam, she extended her arm and snagged the tip of her knife on a fringe of bobbin lace, slicing it in half. She stared at the ragged wound in the lace, at the frayed ends of the parchment-coloured strands that wriggled across the overgown like so many contorted worms, stared, and felt a hysterical laugh claw at her throat, even as a tear formed in her eye.
Could her luck be any worse? The bobbin lace was the most valuable part of the dress. Even though lace required skill to make, its rarity and expense were mainly due to its central ingredient, vast, copious, mind-numbing, and deadening amounts of time. It took so long to produce that if you attempted to create a lace veil by yourself, your progress would be measured not in weeks, but in months. Ounce for ounce, lace was worth more than gold or silver.
She ran her fingers over the band of threads, pausing on the rift that she had created.
It's not as if lace takes that much energy, just time.
She hated making it herself.
Energy, energy. At that moment, a series of images flashed through her mind. Orin talking about using magic for research. Triana, the woman who had helmed Duvrangorgata since the twins' death, looking up at one of the Varden's healers while he explained the principles of magic to Nasuada when she was only 5 or 6 years old. The disparate experiences formed a chain of reasoning that was so outrageous and unlikely, it finally released the laugh imprisoned in her throat. Faraka gave her an odd look and waited for an explanation. Standing, Nasuada tumbled half the overgown off her lap and onto the floor.
"Fetch me Triana this instant," she said. "I don't care what she's doing, bring her here." The skin around Faraka's eyes tightened, but she curtsied and said,
"As you wish, ma'am."
She departed through the hidden servant's door.
"Thank you,"
Nasuada whispered in the empty room. She understood her maid's reluctance. She too felt uncomfortable whenever she had to interact with magic users. Indeed, she only trusted Aragorn because he was a rider, although that was no proof of virtue, as Galbatorix had shown, and because of his oath of fealty, which Nasuada knew he would never break. It scared her to consider magicians' and sorcerers' powers. The thought that a seemingly ordinary person could kill with a word, invade your mind if he or she wished, cheat, lie, and steal without being caught, and otherwise defy society with near impunity. Her heart quickened. How did you enforce the law when a certain segment of the population possessed special powers? At its most basic level, the Varden's war against the Empire was nothing more than an attempt to bring to justice a man who had abused his magical abilities and to prevent him from committing further crimes. All this pain and destruction because no one had the strength to defeat Galbatorix. He won't even die after a normal span of years. Although she disliked magic, she knew that it would play a crucial role in removing Galbatorix, and that she could not afford to alienate its practitioners until victory was assured. Once that occurred, she intended to resolve the problem that they presented. A brazen knock on her chamber door disturbed her thoughts. Fixing a pleasant smile on her face and guarding her mind as she had been trained, Nasuada said, "Enter." It was important that she appear polite after summoning Triana in such a rude manner. The door thrust open, and the brunette sorceress strode into the room, her tousled locks piled high above her head with obvious haste. She looked as if she had just been roused from bed. Bowing in the dwarven fashion, she said,
You asked for me, lady?
I did. Relaxing into a chair, Nasuada let her gaze slowly drift up and down Triana. The sorceress lifted her chin under Nasuada's examination.
I need to know, what is the most important rule of magic?
Triana frowned.
That whatever you do with magic requires the same amount of energy as it would to do otherwise. And what you can do is only limited by your ingenuity and by your knowledge of the ancient language?
Other strictures apply, but in general, yes. Lady, why do you ask? These are basic principles of magic that, while not commonly bandied about, I am sure you are familiar with.
I am. I wished to ensure that I understood them properly.
Without moving from her chair, Nasuada reached down and lifted the overgown so that Triana could see the mutilated lace.
So then, within those limits, you should be able to devise a spell that will allow you to manufacture lace with magic.
A condescending sneer distorted the sorceress's dark lips.
Duvranga Gata has more important duties than repairing your clothes, lady. Our art is not so common as to be employed for mere whims. I am sure that you will find your seamstresses and tailors more than capable of fulfilling your request. Now, if you will excuse me, I...
Be quiet, woman, said Nasuada in a flat voice. Astonishment muted Triana in mid-sentence.
I see that I must teach Duvranga Gata the same lesson that I taught the Council of Elders. I may be young, but I am no child to be patronized. I ask about lace, because if you can manufacture it quickly and easily with magic, then we can support the Varden by selling inexpensive bobbin and needle lace throughout the Empire. Galbatorix's own people will provide the funds we need to survive.
But that's ridiculous, protested Triana. Even Farrakhan looked skeptical.
You can't pay for a war with lace?
Nasuada raised an eyebrow.
Why not? Women who otherwise could never afford to own lace will leap at the chance to buy ours. Every farmer's wife who longs to appear richer than she is will want it. Even wealthy merchants and nobles will give us their gold, because our lace will be finer than any thrown or stitched by human hands. We'll garner a fortune to rival the dwarves. That is, if you are skilled enough in magic to do what I want.
Triana tossed her hair.
You doubt my abilities? Can it be done?
Triana hesitated, then took the overgown from Nasuada and studied the lace strip for a long while. At last she said,
It should be possible, but I'll have to conduct some tests before I know for certain. Do so immediately. From now on, this is your most important assignment, and find an experienced lace maker to advise you on the patterns.
Yes, Lady Nasuada. Nasuada allowed her voice to soften.
Good. I also want you to select the brightest members of Duvranga Gata and work with them to invent other magical techniques that will help the Varden. That's your responsibility, not mine.
Yes, Lady Nasuada.
Now you are excused. Report back to me tomorrow morning.
Yes, Lady Nasuada. Satisfied, Nasuada watched the sorceress depart, then closed her eyes and allowed herself to enjoy a moment of pride for what she had accomplished. She knew that no man, not even her father, would have thought of her solution.
This is my contribution to the Varden, she told herself, wishing that Arjihad could witness it.
Louder, she asked,
Did I surprise you, Farrakhan? You always do, ma'am.
Elva. Ma'am, you're needed, ma'am.
What?
Reluctant to move, Nasuada opened her eyes and saw Jormunda enter the room. The wiry veteran pulled off his helm, tucked it in the crook of his right arm, and made his way to her, with his left hand planted on the pommel of his sword. The links of his hauberk clinked as he bowed.
My lady.
Welcome, Jormunda. How is your son today?
She was pleased that he had come. Of all the members of the Council of Elders, he had accepted her leadership the most easily, serving her with the same dogged loyalty and determination as he had Arjihad.
If all my warriors were like him, no one could stop us.
His cough has subsided.
I'm glad to hear it. Now, what brings you?
Lines appeared on Jormunder's forehead. He ran his free hand over his hair, which was tied back in a ponytail, then caught himself and pushed his hand back down to his side.
Magic of the strangest kind.
Oh?
Do you remember the babe that Aragorn blessed?
Aye. Nasuada had seen her only once, but she was well aware of the exaggerated tales about the child that circulated among the Varden, as well as the Varden's hopes for what the girl might achieve once she grew up. Nasuada was more pragmatic about the subject. Whatever the infant became, it would not be for many years, by which time the battle with Galbatorix would already be won or lost.
I've been asked to take you to her.
Asked? By whom? And why?
A boy on the practice field told me that you should visit the child. Said that you would find it interesting. He refused to give his name, but he looked like what that witch's weircat is supposed to turn into, so I thought... Well, I thought you should know.
Jormunder looked embarrassed. I asked my men questions about the girl, and I heard things. That she's... different.
In what way?
He shrugged.
Enough to believe that you should do what the weircat says.
Nasuada frowned. She knew from the old stories that ignoring a weircat was the height of folly and often led to one's doom. However, his companion, Angela the Herbalist, was another magic user that Nasuada did not entirely trust. She was too independent and unpredictable.
Magic, she said, making it a curse.
Magic, agreed Jormunder, though he used it as a word of awe and fear. Very well, let us go visit this child. Is she within the castle?
Orin gave her and her caretaker rooms on the west side of the keep.
Take me to her.
Gathering up her skirts, Nasuada ordered Farika to postpone the rest of the day's appointments, then left the chambers.
Behind her, she heard Jormunder snap his fingers as he directed four guards to take up positions around her. A moment later, he joined her side, pointing out their course.
The heat within Borromeo Castle had increased to the point where they felt as if they were trapped within a giant bread oven. The air shimmered like liquid glass along the windowsills. Though she was uncomfortable, Nasuada knew that she dealt with the heat better than most people because of her swarthy skin. The ones who had the hardest time enduring the high temperatures were men like Jormunder and her guards, who had to wear their armor all day long, even if they were stationed out under the lidless gaze of the sun.
Nasuada kept close watch on the five men as sweat gathered on their exposed skin, and their breathing became even more ragged. Since they had arrived in Aberon, a number of the Varden had fainted from heatstroke, two of whom died an hour or two later, and she had no intention of losing more of her subjects by driving them beyond their physical limits. When she deemed they needed a rest, she bade them to stop, overriding their objections, and get drinks of water from a servant.
I can't have you toppling like ninepins.
They had to break twice more before they reached their destination, a nondescript door recessed in the inner wall of the corridor. The floor around it was littered with gifts. Jormunder knocked, and a quavering voice from inside asked,
Who is it?
Lady Nasuada, come to see the child, he said.
Be you of true heart and steadfast resolve?
This time Nasuada answered, My heart is pure, and my resolve is as iron.
Cross the threshold, then, and be welcome.
The door swung open to an entryway, lit by a single red dwarf lantern. No one was at the door. Proceeding inward, Nasuada saw that the walls and ceiling were swathed with layers of dark fabric, giving the place the appearance of a cave or lair. To her surprise, the air was quite cold, almost chilly, like a brisk autumn night. Apprehension sank its poisonous claws into her belly.
Magic!
A black mesh curtain blocked her way. Brushing it aside, she found herself in what was once a sitting room. The furniture had been removed, except for a line of chairs pushed against the shrouded walls. A cluster of faint dwarf lanterns were hung in a dimple of the sagging fabric overhead, casting weird multicoloured shadows in every direction. A bent crone watched her from the depths of one corner,
bracketed by Angela the herbalist and the weercat, who stood with his hackles raised. In the centre of the room knelt a pale girl that Nasawada took to be 3 or 4 years old. The girl picked at a platter of food on her lap. No one spoke. Confused, Nasawada asked, "Where is the baby?" The girl looked up. Nasawada gasped as she saw the dragon mark bright upon the child's brow, and as she peered deep into her violet eyes. The girl quirked her lips with a terrible, knowing smile. "I am Elver." Nasawada recoiled without thinking, clutching at the dagger she kept strapped to her left forearm. It was an adult's voice and filled with an adult's experience and cynicism. It sounded profane coming from the mouth of a child. "Don't run," said Elver. "I'm your friend." She put the platter aside. It was empty now. To the crone, she said, "More food." The old woman hurried from the room. Then Elver patted the floor beside her. "Please sit. I have been waiting for you ever since I learned to talk." Keeping her grip on her dagger, Nasawada lowered herself to the stones. "When was that?" "Last week." Elver folded her hands in her lap. She fixed her ghastly eyes on Nasawada, pinning her in place through the unnatural strength of her gaze. Nasawada felt as if a violet lance had pierced her skull and was twisting inside her mind, tearing apart her thoughts and memories. She fought the desire to scream. Leaning forward, Elver reached out and cupped Nasawada's cheek with one soft hand. "You know, Arjihad could not have led the Vardhan better than you have. You chose the correct path. Your name will be praised for centuries for having the courage and foresight to move the Vardhan to Sirda and attack the Empire when everyone else thought it was insane to do so." Nasawada gaped at the girl, stunned. Like a key matched to a lock, Elva's words perfectly addressed Nasawada's primal fears, the doubts that kept her awake at night, sweating in the darkness. An involuntary surge of emotion rushed through her, bolstering her with a sense of confidence and peace that she had not possessed since before Arjihad's death. Tears of relief burst from her eyes and rolled down her face. It was as if Elva had known exactly what to say in order to comfort her. Nasawada loathed her for it. Her euphoria warred against her distaste for how this moment of weakness had been induced, and by whom. Nor did she trust the girl's motivation. "What are you?" she demanded. "I am what Aragorn made me." "He blessed you." The dreadful ancient eyes were obscured for a moment as Elver blinked. "He did not understand his actions. Since Aragorn ensorcelled me, whenever I see a person, I sense all the hurts that beset him and are about to beset him. When I was smaller, I could do nothing about it. So I grew bigger. Why would... The magic in my blood drives me to protect people from pain, no matter the injury to myself or whether I want to help or not." Her smile acquired a bitter twist. "It costs me dearly if I resist the urge." As Nasawada digested the implications, she realized that Elva's unsettling aspect was a byproduct of the suffering that she had been exposed to. Nasawada shivered at the thought of what the girl had endured. It must have torn her apart to have this compulsion and yet be unable to act on it. Against her better judgment, she began to feel a measure of sympathy for Elva. "Why have you told me this?" "I thought that you should know who and what I am." Elver paused, and the fire in her gaze strengthened. "And that I will fight for you however I can. Use me as you would an assassin, in hiding, in the dark, and without mercy." She laughed with a high, chilling voice. "You wonder why. I see you do. Because unless this war ends, and sooner rather than later, it will drive me insane. I find it hard enough to deal with the agonies of everyday life without also having to confront the atrocities of battle.
Use me to end it, and I'll ensure that your life is as happy as any human has had the privilege to experience." At that moment the crone scurried back into the room, bowed to Elva, and handed her a new platter of food. It was a physical relief to Nasuada, as Elva looked down and attacked